Hello and welcome to Audible River. I'm Alan Rice, and I am very happy to have with me Dr. Miriam Marsolet, a practicing psychotherapist and Jungian analyst. She is also founder and instructor at White Magnolia Tai Chi School in Kensington, California. Hello, Miriam. It's very wonderful to see you today.
Hello, Alan. It's lovely to be here.
That's great. You know, to open up, I think I would like to talk to you about what is being a Jungian analyst. Can you just tell me what that is?
Yes. For me, it's being a companion on a journey that is connected with our waking consciousness and deeper sleeping consciousness, where they learn to converse with each other and to inform each other. Our waking consciousness and sleeping consciousness have very different sets of rules, but they're, you know, it's the same person.
Okay.
And our natural sleeping consciousness has really important transformational functions related to healing and meaning and growth. And life experiences can wound that. And we can develop and use capacity of our waking consciousness to heal that sleeping consciousness so it can perform its natural functions again. And one more thing, frequently our sleeping selves, the unconscious, it has a capacity to access experience and emotions long before waking consciousness can. So if we're dealing with things like blocked emotion, cut off emotion due to trauma, if you can work in a very sensitive, relational, conversational way with dream consciousness, that dream consciousness can offer the blocked emotions years before you'd ever access them through conventional waking paths.
This is fascinating. You know, I've never really, I mean, you've given me a lot of new thoughts there with that. The idea of one person having two ongoing sets of consciousness, the waking consciousness and what you're calling the sleeping consciousness.
Yes.
And that's something that we can all relate to, you know, but we know that something's going on while we're asleep. Sometimes we remember our dreams. But when we are awake, what is that sleeping consciousness doing? What is it up to when we're awake? Is it still, what do you have to say about that?
It's alive, and it has listening capacity, and it waits for invitations to engage, and in times of danger or intense need to know something, it kind of erupts, and it can erupt in terms of waking experiences or powerful dreams. I think experiences that we may label paranormal, I would say psychic experiences, kind of deja vu experiences. I think these are all ways where these broader capacities of the unconscious flow around the rules of our waking consciousness. And they offer needed information. There, you know, Jung mentioned the teleological nature of the unconscious. It's kind of like it's future oriented, it's goal oriented, it's growth oriented, and it wants us to open up and evolve and grow. And so it's kind of there waiting to help us. And sometimes through severe trauma, it gets put in fetters.
Oh.
It becomes wounded. It can't do that. And, you know, Freud noticed and Jung too, that with unprocessed trauma, you frequently get recurrent nightmares. You know, things that come again and again, and they just don't change.
Okay.
It's locked. The working psyche, it's not constrained by more logical, rational waking rules.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to make sense. In fact, the stronger its medicine is, the more bizarre the dreams. It's metaphor play, symbol play, archetypal play. It reaches beyond our own unique world and accesses symbols across time and across place to help us open into a sense of creative freedom. And, you know, different people experience this in very different ways.
I can imagine. You know, what you're talking about there sounds a lot to me like shamans or, you know, people who, you know, indigenous people who, you know, practice altered states. This sounds a lot like what people in those traditions are accessing, this what you're calling the, you know, this sleeping consciousness. And also, too, I'm picking up some clues from what you're saying. It sounds like the sleeping consciousness is not bound to time and space the way the waking consciousness is. I mean, like when I'm sitting here, I'm in a room and I know what time it is and that sort of thing. And this is my waking consciousness talking to you. But at the same time, I've got this other connection that's aware beyond time and space, but I'm not entirely conscious of it unless I'm working on that relationship. I'm sort of trying to reflect back what I'm learning from you right now. Does that sound good, or you have something to add to that?
That sounds exactly good. And in fact, Jung, you know, when I trained at the Jung Institute, one of our modules where we had to write had to deal with exploring a kind of indigenous native experience. For instance, you know, he was very interested in the shamans of Siberia and his travels to Africa because he sensed that these experiences were very relevant to the truth of all of our psyches.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself had some experience working with a Lakota sun dancer before I went to Zurich. And so I chose the Lakota sun dance, but it's very much linked. And, you know, I'd also say, you know, I think every spiritual experience touches upon this, every religious tradition kind of acknowledges this in its own ways. It has its own frameworks. But for instance, if you look at Buddhism, let's say Tibetan Buddhism.
Right.
Each sense, in a way, is considered its own kind of consciousness.
And what do you mean by each sense? Go ahead.
They would say there are six. Our five, touch, taste, fragrance, sight, smell. Each one is its own consciousness. And then there's a sixth, which is the mind, which is not the analytic mind. It's the perceptive experiencing mind.
Okay.
And you see, this makes sense. A dog's life is centered around smell.
Right.
That is consciousness. There is bat hearing-centered consciousness. There's human and cat vision-centered consciousness. You know, think of octopus, maybe touch-centered consciousness. These are all ways of being in the world and experiencing the world. And of course, we humans, we have enormous capacity to settle into and open into these consciousnesses. And Jung's path to individuation, which doesn't mean becoming an individual. What it is that the conscious, you know, our waking consciousness, and the unconscious, our sleeping consciousness, become capable of a conversation with each other that evolves. It's not one being merged and subsumed by the other. So the conscious and unconscious become individuated enough to be able to engage in a meaningful, growing conversation. And that's really what Jungian analysis is for those of that orientation. You know, I had a huge trauma experience myself when I was 26. I had experienced an 80% burn, followed by,
wow,
you know, 30 surgeries. I went to bed 26, woke up 96 with a,
oh my,
you know, I think they gave me a 5% chance of survival. But, you know, it took time. You know, there was the period of dissociation, the period of depression. But when I, even in the midst, when the depression was coming in, dreams activated. Oh my gosh. The exquisite texture of these dreams. And there was a moment, you know, I was thinking, I never had this sense of I'm going to do it, but it was like, I'm keeping the Golden Gate Bridge in my consciousness if I'm ever going to jump, you know?
Wow.
And when I came closest, I picked up my dream journal and I had a fireplace in the cottage I was renting. And I thought, I can't burn my dreams, so I can't kill myself. You know, that was his, I cannot. This is something not possible. So therefore, and then I came across Jung in a footnote and he was like, oh my God, this man understands my experience and I've got to go to Zurich. And, you know, things unfold from there.
Wow, that's an incredible story. I mean, but it's more than a story. I mean, I could, you know, sense from what the way you told, that's a quite the journey, the way that you were able to experience through this trauma, this huge challenge, these different levels of knowing what, but it, you know, it came back to you, what was alive in you. I mean, this is what I'm thinking. When you couldn't burn your dream journal, there was something that I'm just imagining, you know, that what a relishing experience that is to know that you that there's something that vital in you that you recognize.
Yeah. Wow. It's lovely hearing your responses. You know, I feel like we're siblings on the path, because the most important things, you just hear them and you restate them in a way that is feels so true.
Okay, well, thank you. Oh, well,
not that I wish my path. I love my path, but I wouldn't wish it on anyone. So,
well, I you know, I mean, honestly, I mean, it's no way to compare suffering and that kind of thing, but we all get to where we are through some sort of challenges, I think. You know, and yeah, some seem like more and some seem like less, to, you know, depending on your perspective. But yeah, I mean, I can definitely relate in my own way. Imagine being in your experience. And it's, to me, you know, that's kind of like my quest in life. And it becomes more and more interesting to connect with other people. And this is, I think this is something that I'm growing into currently to understand better, is how when we are working on ourselves and we are opening up to this inner life, how it sometimes inadvertently opens us up to others. And so, mm-hmm, what do you think about that? How does that ring true to you? Or
that has come to be kind of the heart of my sense of what life is about, that, you know, that this sense of connection creates magic.
Ah.
And I would take it maybe even a little further, you know, and say, you know, you and I are here connecting. We're having a conversation. Something is being created right now as a result of our exchange. And it's new and it's fresh. And it's very distinctive. And it's because you and I are connecting in this moment.
Right.
And that's kind of been the kind of guiding source of the way I work with clients or pursue my own spiritual journey or work my way through my difficult times. Now it's like, okay, who is here now? What are the possibilities here now? We don't need to think that we have to do something definitive that's going to last forever. You and I, or my client and I, or my garden and I, you know, or my tortured mind and I simply need to connect right now and see what arises. And it is quite stunning how lovely surprises happen.
It is. It's that creative force, I guess, that's, you know, maybe coming from the, you know, the sleeping consciousness or whatever. You know, myself, I've, my whole life, I think I've been motivated by two things, and that is, you know, a search for spiritual truth and a search for artistic beauty, you know, and artistic beauty, that's very subjective, so we won't go into that. But it's the, you know, going beyond like creating objects, but looking at my life as every decision being something that is an artistic expression or, you know, coordinates with something that's, like deep to my nature, like feeling it at that level. And I feel like that, yes, these sort of things where we're making connections person to person, that these are like artistic expressions. So that's, I relate to what you were saying there. You know, one other thing that I wanted to talk to you about, and as and this is a Jungian concept, and it goes back to when I was a kid, a small boy trying to figure life out. I grew up in a fundamental Christian church. Some of the ideas about God, you know, I really liked, you know, that, you know, believing in something strongly, because that was, it felt powerful to me. But some of the ideas of God didn't sound quite right, and I had this idea that God was really everybody, that the mind of God was everybody's mind put together. And so I had this concept, I guess I was like about 7 or 8 years old, that it was somehow our inner life, every person's inner life, that was contributing to whatever God is. That was my, you know, as a child trying to piece things together. But the core thing about that I look back on now is that there was this idea of some sort of unifying force or existence that we all shared. And so I know that in a very, very popular, you know, idea that's coming out of Jung's work is the collective unconscious. And maybe that's what you mean by the sleeping consciousness. I don't know. But I'd like to talk a little bit more about the collective unconscious, what you think it is, and what you think it isn't, maybe, too.
Yeah, it's a little bit different than what we would call the personal unconscious in Jung's thought. And I experienced that distinction in myself too, that the personal unconscious, it really arises in relation to the moment and the day and the time and my own experience. It's a sleeping personal treasure trove of potential. Whereas collective unconscious, through my own experience and through Jung's thought, it's beyond that. And it is very much something that includes us all in his thought and also in my experience. I think that religious traditions have their own way of vocalizing this, But I have had quite strong experiences where I feel I have touched upon an aspect of consciousness that is larger than myself. It must be collective. It does involve others. And Jung, through all of his research, noticed the symbolic language and archetypal patterns in all the classical literature and things. So he said, you know, this is bigger than us. And I think he felt this was certainly an aspect of what we call God, that most doctrines and dogmas, in the way they describe God, put God in a box that's a little bit too small. Because humans don't like to not understand. Waking consciousness likes understanding. It's one of our gifts, but the result is we tend to put things in boxes that are a little bit too small for the actuality, you know?
Yeah, it's good to package things up and put them away and not have to think about them afterwards. I mean,
Yeah.
it's reassuring in a way, but sometimes those boxes just fall off and want to come back alive.
Yeah.
And now the collective unconscious, it's interesting to me because I mean, it to me it seems like it really, I'm not sure that there's a real map or a real definition. I just think that, I mean, I don't know, but it feels like that a number of people kind of know what it is. We've touched into it. We have a way of describing, like you were just saying, we can relate in a way to experiences that make it seem real to us. That's like, okay, I think I know what that is. And one of the curious things to me is that I've known several times in my life people who have told me that, hey, I just had a dream about you, and we were doing this, this, and this. And I said, oh my God, I had the same dream. And you were in it. And so I know that this isn't, like an everyday experience, but enough people have these sort of shared dreams. And it sure makes you wonder, how is that even possible without some shared unconscious space?
Yeah. That people, Jung was asked in his later years, do you believe in God? And his answer was, I don't believe I know. And meaning I experience. And, it's not something you can often put in terms of belief. Belief might be a little bit too small for the experience of what Jung regarded as God, perhaps collective unconscious, perhaps bigger than that. Einstein said something similar. There has to be something greater, and I think, and as something easier way to think of it is, do you believe in love?
Oh, right.
Well, I don't believe I know.
You know.
Okay, what is love? Can you prove to me love is here? Can you prove to me love is not here? Well, kind of good luck. But I
yes.
know love.
But
I experience love.
you can be certain that you know love, right? Without
Yeah.
having to prove it or believe in it, right?
Yeah. And if you try to do it, it might be fun party if you've got enough alcohol on hand, but probably not going to work.
It just is.
Or maybe mushrooms or something else.
Yes. Yeah, people do experiment a lot, and that's part of being human. Now,
Sure. Yeah.
and along those lines, I know that Jung was quite
You
the.
know, and
Go
I
ahead.
would
Yeah.
say,
Yeah, go ahead.
I think with some of these plant medicines, they give access to other forms of consciousness, I think.
Oh.
That each plant offers its gateway to its own kind of consciousness. And it's quite, a plant medicine can be just as rich as a dream in terms of opening gateways towards possibilities
Oh.
for creativity and change and healing and
Absolutely. Absolutely. I know that there are, I mean, there you get into, I mean, in regards to popular culture, you get into tricky territory, because I think that, I mean, someone who is earnest and prepared and goes into an experience like that, they could have something very enriching or something that's profound in any case, right? But I think that, but I hear stories from people who are just like, oh, yeah, I went and did my ayahuasca trip and it was amazing and we had so much fun. I'm like, you know, it just sounds like that you're just using this for recreation and maybe you're gaining something out of it. But I think that a lot of it goes back to the intention of individuals. But at least we're having the conversation in this modern age. And I think that that's a positive thing, that we're, that it's something that we're talking about, personal growth and, you know, opening up to other types of consciousness and however people seek it out. You know, there may be maybe some, you know, short-term issues with it, but I think overall it's a positive thing.
I do, and I kind of regard it in the same way as therapy. You know, there's different therapeutic schools. And what is going to be good for what depends on the person, their history. And the thing that concerns me about people going off on their own is that if there is relational trauma, to me, that needs to be healed and transformed in the frame of a safe relationship, a safe guiding relationship. And I think when people go off alone, doors may be open that a person does not have the ability in that moment to be safe with. And so I just like to see it guided, you know, I like to see people have access to someone who has wisdom around whatever process plant medicine is being used. That's my preference. And, yeah.
Well, that sounds like very, very sound advice, in my opinion. And yeah, I know that, like, for myself, you know, I'm in my mid 60s, and I have to admit that I am still finding things in myself. I think that I've done a lot of personal work. I've done therapy. I had a rough childhood, so now I'm okay with it. But the funny thing about it, and I bring this, you know, it goes back to the plant medicine, I'll circle back to that, is that however far I get, I find that there's other levels that trauma has affected me. And that as I grow, I find that I can't get further because I've got this thing blocking me that I didn't even know was there until I got there. And it's something maybe painful or a reaction that I don't have control over. And I look into it and realize that, well, this happened 50 years ago. And I do know, you know, from my little bit of experience, you know, with, you know, you know, altered states of consciousness with, you know, chemical alteration, that, yeah, you can be suddenly thrust into states of mind where you're not ready to face these things because you don't know what's happening. You don't know why it's there. And it's more frightening than helpful. So, yeah, I agree. That's I think that the mentorship in my personal life, I think that I grew up the way that I grew up, I didn't meet enough people that I trusted. And that was a problem for me most of my life. And so as I've gone on, I meet more people like yourself that I feel there's a kinship with someone who's taken a closer look at the kind of experiences that I've had and that I, you know, trust to be with. But this is something that came much later in my life that I developed this kind of trust with being able to work with people.
Yeah. And I would just say that most of us who do this work, many of us have had experiences when we were young, like the ones you describe. Mm-hmm. And we also come into situations, even however later in our lives, where it's like, oh, geez, Louise, here, I thought this was long taken care of, and here it is.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so it's nice to have developed a kind of relational a kind of very process oriented way of living, where whatever comes, it's like, oh, well, look who's walked into the room now.
Right.
So it's like, this, there's a boogeyman in that closet I wasn't aware of. Well, hello, boogeyman. Because without that, one can easily go to what's wrong with me. How am I so stupid to have not worked that out by now? And that's really not where we want to go.
No, no, absolutely. So, but that brings me around to another Jungian term that I hear people use, and that is the shadow. And are we kind of touching on that now with what we're talking about here? Or is that even a relevant term anymore? How would you describe that?
No, I think it is. The shadow is, they call there's personal and there's collective shadow.
Okay.
And it's aspects that our waking consciousness is not so aware of. And they will come forward in terms of images and dreams. And there can be positive shadow and negative shadow. And it's processes or attributes or feelings. Issues that are there asleep or running in the background enough that our waking consciousness isn't picking them up. It's like the program's running in the background of conscious awareness.
Okay.
And I think positive capacities and traits are as common in shadow as negative.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. I haven't heard it framed that way. That it's just what is something that's automatically running in our background, and that when we're not thinking about it, but it can be positive or negative. It could be, like what I was speaking of earlier, is like realizing that I've got these reactions that are uncomfortable. That would be a negative shadow, let's say, that's holding me back. But if I've got like these natural urges to create and meet people or do things, that maybe that's a positive shadow that's acting on its own. Is that sort of what we're talking about? Or
there's one more distinction. Shadow, in the Jungian terms, they take patterns. They're typical archetypal patterns.
Okay.
And if we're really working with them, usually those will reveal themselves if we take the time and allow them to open up. Sometimes what discomfort is traumatic memories being activated or a capacity being activated that's truly warning us of a danger.
Oh.
Or it's warning us that there's a correction that needs to be, a course that needs to be made.
Mm-hmm.
If we put ourselves, if we make a commitment to a situation that's not right for us, we're going to find ourselves pretty easily triggered when we're engaging in that. It's like our whole psyche is wanting to say, would you think this through over again?
Right.
So it could be part of our natural warning system. It could be, also, I call it post-traumatic static.
Okay.
There's a kind of like, your little finger is still in the wall socket.
Got it. Yeah, I can relate to that. Yes.
It can be a number of things, yeah.
Yes. Another thing that, I have to say, what is it? Maybe 2 years ago. I haven't read a lot of Jung's work. I'm not very much of an academic student myself. But when I came across the Red Book, that was something that really got my interest. And just for the listeners, the Red Book, as it turns out, was something that wasn't published until much, much, much later. I think it wasn't until like the 1960s, and it was kept secret for a long time. And it was Jung's record of his own delving into his own unconscious, and it was the work that he did to develop a lot of his theories about the unconscious. Now I'm bringing it up because I'm not really clear exactly how he got all of that information, how he did it, but is active imagination something that you could comment on? I think that Jung, this was something that he did, that he taught others, and maybe that's what he was doing when he wrote the Red Book.
Yeah, I think very much so. I think one thing that's important to understand is that the Red Book contains, you know, it's his journal of his process that emerged just after his break with Freud. And that was a profoundly traumatic period for him. And Jung was a brilliant man. You know, he was a working psychiatrist, and he understood that in order to maintain his sanity, he needed to keep working, holding himself accountable to day-to-day tasks. But he also felt that there was something arising in him that was so strong that he needs to either work with it or perhaps be consumed by it.
Wow.
And so this was his way of working with this powerful unconscious material. And really, that is what active imagination is. Now, many of us don't have the extraordinary power of the psyche of Jung. And, you know, we're not surrounded by the culture that he was, for better and for worse. So our processes are not as powerful. But to engage in a kind of conversation that can involve language or symbol or art in an ongoing way with figures that emerge in our psyche, it can be a profound and powerful experience. And the process involves doing our best to let go of the rules of language and of usual functioning when we're awake, and kind of untie that and let ourselves move towards the sleep consciousness way of functioning, but we're awake. And so we can access while awake the energies and symbols of sleep. And, you know, I had a years-long activation process with a simple image that emerged, a simple visual image that emerged in one dream.
Wow.
And it this figure became quite a source of companionship and wisdom, you know. And
interesting.
So, yes, I think his experience of active imagination planted the seed of what was later, I mean, his experience recorded in the Red Book, it was like a seed of what he and his close followers in subsequent years developed and taught and articulated as active imagination. There's a wonderful book by Barbara Hanna, one of his original followers, called Active Imagination, Encounters with the Soul. And I just love that book.
Well, I might check that one out.
It's an oldie but goodie.
Wow. So that active imagination, I can relate to that in some ways, because sometimes I've had dreams that I woke up before. I mean, it felt like a profound dream, and I woke up before I felt the dream was done. And then in the morning, I will set and put myself back into that state, just imagining I'm back in the dream because I want to finish it. So that's a form of active imagination. That's a form of what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yes.
Because I want to finish. Go ahead.
You want to do it, you know, do exactly what you did and pick up a pen and write down what comes and don't try to have it make sense. Just put down what happens and let it flow. But one piece of advice that the teachers I had in Zurich would always give, I think is great, is don't do this with actual life figures.
Okay.
So, you know, if you have a horrible dream of your mother or father of a person, it's not a good idea to engage in an active imagination-like process with these figures. That, I think, is better to work with in terms of maybe, you know, portrayals and work with a therapist, but don't, active imagination is something different and it can have very powerful impact because it does access broader levels of consciousness. And I think just in fairness to the other person, I'm not saying he's like a voodoo doll, but it's just better to work with less personal imagery and active imagination. And you see that in Jung's Red Book.
Yes. Oh, very good.
Gross. Come here, sweetie. Somebody slammed the door. Yeah.
And let's see, what was I just thinking? Okay, so the active imagination. So let's talk a little bit more about individuation. I know you touched on that earlier, and I know that you know, this in Jungian psychology, this is a desired state, something to work towards. And so, how does somebody go about? You were speaking of becoming conscious, developing a relationship between the waking mind and the sleeping mind in a meaningful way. Can you talk some more about that, and then a little more detail about the process? What's it like to move toward individuation?
It usually starts from a place, you know, Jung used alchemical imagery for this. It's like the lotus grows out of the mud. And the open lotus is the culmination of the individual process, and the mud is where it starts. And, you know, Jung would say, you know, maybe just don't do this unless you really feel you have to.
Okay.
Because it can lead you to some places you may not want to go. But, you know, if you really feel you must go on this journey, then do this. And I would say it's good to have an experienced guide. Mm-hmm. Who you trust and who is truly safe. Because there's, you know, plenty of people who are not quite aware enough to not cause harm out there in different capacities. So you know, test a person out. And if you want to work with someone, you know, test them out and let your psyche respond and never feel afraid to stop. If you feel something's not working,
okay,
you know, maintain your ground. And then in a Jungian sense, it often, once you start, your dreams will present. And you will develop a kind of conversational relationship with dreams, and they will evolve. And it'll be like, it is almost like a kind of shamanic journey.
I was thinking that, yes, shamanic journeying, very similar. Yes, go ahead.
Very similar.
And so then, as you continue on this journey of individuating, you know, I'll just tell you my idea of what it feels like, and that is that, and see if this makes any sense to you or has any relationship to what we're talking about. But I have a sense that at the core of all of us, that there is a central authenticity, and there's different names for it, and it's like, you know, what is it like? I just talked to a Buddhist lama who called it, what do you call it, the authentic Buddha self or something.
Did he call it the fundamental ground?
The what?
Did he call it the fundamental ground?
Oh yes, yeah, right. So there's something that I feel, it's like it, and like you're saying, like it feels like something that wants to break free, that contains everything, and that from where my normal consciousness is, it's always working out who is that and what do we need to do to get to you, and how do we let you out? So I'm coming to you with this question. How does this relate to anything that you know? Does this relate to Jungian psychology, individuation, or is it something else altogether that you're thinking when I'm talking about this?
I can definitely feel it in my experience of both Jungian work and in work in different spiritual traditions, in the Jungian context, and this is what I experienced in my dreams that were emerging.
Mm-hmm.
And I did not know what they were. But I can tell you, the first dream, this was the one that, it was the first one I ever wrote down. It was about, I think it was about 2 years after the fire. And a lot of the healing process was very much in the future. But in this dream, and this was a time when I was still wearing full pressure garments and
wow.
splint. You know, it took a team to get me all garbed up to go to sleep to prevent the contractures. But in that dream, I went to sleep. And then I had a dream. I fell asleep. I had a dream. And in the dream, I fell asleep and had another dream.
My goodness. Okay. That's rare.
Yeah, it was quite a dream. And in the dream, my dear friend, who is the person who came and whose face, when he saw me the night of the fire, let me know what had happened to me. Because, you know, it was so shocking. I saw his face, what happened. That person came and he turned my head to the foot of the bed and my feet to the head of the bed in the dream's dream.
Mm-hmm.
And then I opened a book. And in that book, I read, if you place your feet in the lead and turn your head toward that part of you capable of endless weeping, which I knew was the womb in the dream,
mm-hmm.
then you will find peace. And in the dream stream, I tried to tell my friend this wonderful thing I'd read, but I could see he already knew.
Oh, interesting.
And then I woke up. And I wasn't doing any dream work at that time, but I felt like I was in a mystical state for about a week after that dream. So it's like my unconscious had something it wanted me to know. And it erupted forth. And really, that dream is as relevant and alive now as it was when it emerged when I was 28. You know, I'm 67 now, 66, almost 67.
Mm-hmm. My, amazing. That's...
So, yeah, I say what you say is yes, for some people.
For some people. Well, Miriam, I've loved our conversation today. This has been, you know, really great to meet you and to talk about these things that are meaningful to me, and to get your input and especially your wisdom from your experience and training to share with me today. Is there? I'm just wondering, like, before we close, I wanted to get an idea from you about a view of, and maybe this is too big of a question, but I kind of like the view of humanity. Like, where do you feel like, do you have a sense of like where we are in history, where we're going? What do you feel like our path is right now? But I know we're looking at it from our own perspective, but from your work, how do you look forward at the future of where we are?
Well,
I mean, no, that's a tough question.
That's a hard question for me because by nature, I'm kind of optimistic to the point of not wanting to see
mm-hmm.
the negative. And so I kind of go into hiding. And I don't know what to make of things. In my fundamental being, I always feel the sense of hope. But then I also look around, I say, am I deluding myself? You know, so I would say I don't have a vision in that way, but that I feel hope and doubt and fear. That's just where I am. I don't have a sense of clarity there.
Well, you know what, though? I think that Yeah, I think that that's you know, people I talk to, that's a very common experience. And the reason that I asked that today is that I know that Carl Jung in his life had a visceral experience of what he felt was a common experience, and it was an unconscious thing going on. And I just thought I would, you know, throw that at you. But it's interesting that your answer in its uncertainty confirms my own perception. oddly enough, does that make sense?
In terms of my place in the world, I can be clearer. It's
right
to enter into relationship in this moment.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of extending it out, I don't feel clarity.
Yeah,
we have gifts in that way that I don't.
Yeah. Well, it's wonderful to really have a strong sense of how we touch the world where we are, to have a certainty about who we are and how we can engage as we move through the world. I mean, it's a wonderful gift and a wonderful place to be, and I really appreciate talking with you today, Miriam.
Could I just say I love what you're doing? It was such a delight when I got your email, and then I looked at your podcast. It's like, oh my gosh, who is this guy? This is so wonderful. And I listen to your podcasts and the spirit and the curiosity. I love what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, the funny thing is that this is the kind of thing I've done all of my life, you know, and I'm not really, you know, I wouldn't call myself as a, you know, a specialist or educated or that kind of thing. But this is something I've devoted my entire life to, is having these conversations. Mm-hmm. Because I have this curiosity and this need to know. And now with this technology, and it's so easy to do this podcast and put it out there, I just had this idea. I was like, well, maybe other people would like to hear some of these conversations. And I really appreciate you, you know, accepting my invitation. Well, Mary,
You take good care. I really, really am grateful for this conversation we've been able to have and share.
Thank you. Thank you. And that is all for this episode of Audible River. To all of our listeners, I would love to hear your comments about our episode today and any suggestions you might have for episodes in the future. So please feel free to email me at audibleriverpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.